This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Remember watching educational movies in elementary school? Teacher might have been setting up a VCR, or maybe it was a 16-millimeter projector. Nowadays, of course, YouTube videos. Educational movies are part of a larger genre called non-theatrical film. Now, these include movies shown in churches, museums, fairs, and other non-commercial settings. Any place but a movie theater, get it? Without the pressure to entertain or rack up sales at the box office, non-theatrical filmmakers have critically examined race and American identity, among other things. Hollywood's just now beginning to catch up. Hasn't been much scholarly work on these films, but a new collection intends to fix that. I'm joined by the editors of Screening Race in American Non-Theatrical Film. Allison Nadia Field is an associate professor of cinema and media studies and the director of graduate studies at the University of Chicago. Allie, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. And Marcia Gordon's here as well, our resident movies on the radio expert and a professor of film studies at North Carolina State. Hello, Marcia.
Hello, Frank.
Marcia, tell us about some of the settings that these films were made in. I mean, what kind of films are we talking about here?
Yeah, so this, what I love about this category, it's kind of a clunky idea, non-theatrical films, but it's a big umbrella under which so many things fall. So, yes, educational films, films made for church, films made for industry, but also things like home movies that people were making, you know, of their own families, of their own travels. And when we look at them now, as we do any historical artifact, we learn a lot about the past, and especially on the subject of race, which was not really dealt with in theatrical contexts in a way that's frankly particularly interesting.
Allie, but this does sound like a very large body of work, perhaps uncollected and unarchived. How do you jump into a project like this?
It's amazing. I mean, I think what people don't realize is how non-theatrical films really vastly outnumber films that were made for theatrical exhibition. And so we're talking about just an unwieldy amount of material. There are collectors that have collected these, and part of this project was really to enlist the help of archivists and scholars who we thought kind of were plugged into this area, and to see what they came up with. And we had been working on this project for a long time and doing a series of exhibitions and film showings around Los Angeles and other places. And through that process, we got to know this material. And so the book really represents kind of a sampling of this vast universe.
It's interesting, too, to think about. I mean, you say vast universe, films about anything and everything under the sun, from nonprofits talking about their mission to educational videos, mm-hmm. how to sit up straight and all that. So what is it about race? What can we tell about race and our understanding or a more generalized understanding of race that we may not have gotten had we been watching, you know, Hollywood films over that same period? Allie?
Well, I think what's so interesting is that, you know, as Marcia said, as the big screen was marginalizing people of color, these small screens really help balance the scales. And this was a way for folks to take filmmaking into their own hands. So you have films made by, say, African-American pastors in Oklahoma of their local communities and inviting people in to see themselves on screen, which is really kind of a remarkable thing if we think about the 1920s and what films were doing coming out of something like Birth of a Nation and representation there. And then you have, you know, anthropologists going into communities and interested in kind of the practices and artistic traditions of, say, First Nations people. So there's a huge range of things. And then when we get to the kind of post-civil rights movement, we find that 16-millimeter films were a way for teachers to engage with questions that were very much current in society. And we started seeing more films that kind of had open-ended, you know, structures so that they would really lend themselves to discussions. And often these films would come with discussion guides and study guides for teachers to then guide discussion around the characters and the situations that they would see in the films.
Well, Marcia, we're going to listen to a clip from one of those films that you talk about in the book. Maybe you can set this up for us, though. This is Felicia.
About. So this is a film that was made in 1965, in the spring of 1965, actually by three white UCLA film students who were very socially conscious and interested in trying to understand what it was like for a young person to grow up in a community of color in Southern California. And so they found through a teacher friend, a young woman named Felicia, who is the subject of the film, and they recorded an interview with her, and then they made a day in the life documentary, which is quite extraordinary, and this is really the film that started this collection.
Let's listen to a clip.
All together in all the schools I've attended, there's only been about a total of 6 white kids.
Once I went to summer school at another high school where I was mostly Caucasian kids. They were pretty nice in the classroom, but outside it was a different matter. You know, like we got along in the class all right. We spoke to each other and borrowed pencils and paper and everything and helped each other in our classwork. But outside when they got with their friends, and I guess the same on our side, when we got with ours, we sort of ignored each other. But I think it was more on their part because I used to try to talk to the girl that sat next to me on the outside and she would sort of shy away. I guess she was ashamed to, you know, be seen with me or something. But I didn't pay too much attention to it.
All right, so there's a clip from the 1965 non-theatrical film Felicia, and I'm here with Marcia Gordon and Allie Field, the editors of a new collection of essays about films that never made it to the silver screen. Allie, what do we know about the distribution of that film?
Well, initially, it's really fascinating because the film was finished in spring of 1965. And of course, in August of 1965, that area erupted in a set of rebellions. And the entire world's attention turned to South Central Los Angeles and the area of Watts. And here we have a pre-Watts rebellion portrait of an area that had little to no media attention beforehand. So we have this really rare glimpse of what life was like from the perspective of this African-American teenager. After August 1965, the film, of course, was picked up for educational distribution as a kind of way of understanding the conditions that led to the rebellion in August. And it got distributed by BFA, Bailey Film Associates, as part of a package of films called Minority Youth. And there was a film about a Native American girl, a Mexican American boy, and a Japanese American boy named Akira, which is another film that we talk about. And these films were taken up in classrooms as a way, for students to kind of grapple with the situation and understand the kind of conditions affecting other teenagers across the country.
Wait, and Marcia, I suppose at this point it's worth digging into the history of educational films.
Yes.
And kind of what it was like before this.
Yeah, so 10 years prior to the making of this film, let's say 1955, it's almost impossible to imagine this film existing. What educational films were like were voice of God narration. This is what you should think. Here's what we know about the subject. Not really encouraging discussion or the generation of knowledge from within the students. It was like, here, we're handing you this information. Please don't ask any questions. And what you can hear in that film is this is a first person narration from the young woman from within the community. And the purpose of this film would have been to generate discussion in the classroom. So people talking about, well, how does your life compare to this young woman's life? What privileges do you have or not have because of where you happen to have been born or because of the color of your skin? And so there's a big change happening just in kind of thinking about education more broadly, and that filtered into the classroom material as well.
Allie, do we know anything about the impact? We know now it got wider distribution. It becomes a little more intentional following the Kerner Commission report, the idea that we need to be talking more about this. Do we have any idea what kind of impact it might have had?
So this is interesting. It's very difficult to track reception of classroom films other than anecdotal. So teachers didn't track kind of responses. And so they show up in these catalogs for educational distributors, but it's almost impossible to know what kind of impact beyond anecdotal these films had. And that's part of the difficulty in working with this material is, unlike theatrical films, they don't get reviewed in the same way. They don't have the same kind of paper trail that mainstream films do.
Yeah, we need a Rotten Tomatoes for non-theatrical
films. Oh, no,
we
do not. do not recommend that. Strike that.
Find another way. I want to talk about, because you referenced this, Allie, just a second ago, one of the other films that you talk about in your book that does center on a young Japanese-American man who's trying to figure out his place in society. Now, this is 1971. The film is called Akira, so let's listen to a little bit of it.
At home, I'm in a traditional Japanese atmosphere where we speak Japanese. And we have occasionally have Japanese food, and we have rice every night. But then outside of the home, it seems that I'm in kind of a different world at school, and like being in the band. And I feel that I'm in between, that I don't know if I could readily get along if I had to be in one culture all the time.
And there's a clip from the 1971 non-theatrical film Akira, talking with the editors Allie Field and Marcia Gordon about their new collection of essays called Screening Race in American Non-Theatrical Film. And Allie, maybe you can give us the context for that film.
Yeah, this is a great film. It's about Akira Tana, who's a teenager in Northern California, Japanese-American, and he talks about, it's narrated in his first-person voice, and you see his life and kind of the struggles he has between the traditions of his family and the very conservative upbringing he has at home and the pulls of being an American teenager in California in the 70s and his interest in rock and roll and playing in a rock and roll band. His interest in marijuana. He talks very openly about smoking pot and like what his parents kind of think about it. But he also talks about, you know, the experiences of his parents and, you know, the fact that his father had been interned in a Japanese internment camp and that they never talk about it. And so there's a kind of living history present in his struggles. And the film is really gesturing towards a kind of relatability for other teenagers. And so you can imagine this being shown in a classroom and other teenagers who aren't Japanese American, not struggling with these questions of being in between those two cultures, would relate to other aspects that Akira is talking about. And so this kind of open-ended, kind of broadly relatable character, I think, lended itself to these discussions about, you know, identity, assimilation, reverence for your parents versus striking out on your own.
And I think that's a really important point that Allie just brought up about assimilation. And this is something that's really being talked about in the 1970s. I mean, what does it mean to be an American? You know, what parts of, for people whose parents, you know, came from other countries, what parts of those kind of cultural inheritance are important to retain? And does that stop you from being a full participant in the melting pot dream of what America is? And so there's a relevance, I think, still today to this.
No, and it is fascinating to see these films and to see the subject matter and how much it changes. You made reference, Marcia, to those instructional videos of the 1950s in which race in America was white
yeah.
and other.
Right.
Right. And if you didn't see yourself mm-hmm. in that film, you're other.
Right.
Now everybody's, mm-hmm. you know, by the 60s and 70s, a lot more consciousness. Assimilation is part of it. And also identity, and especially black nationalism, Afrocentrism. So we've got an Afrocentric community school in L.A., and we're going to listen to a clip from the school. Allie, maybe I can have you set it up for us, too, about kind of what's going on in this film.
Sure. So this film is a Jamii Uhuru Shule, which is Swahili for Community Freedom School. And it's a documentary that was made as a student film by Don Amos in 1974. And Don Amos was a student at UCLA, and he was part of what has been called the L.A. Rebellion of Black Filmmakers, who came out of UCLA in the 70s and 80s. And this includes Charles Burnett, Haile Gerima, Julie Dash. These are very well-known, independent filmmakers who are still working today. And this chronicles kind of a day in the life of an Afrocentric elementary school in South Central Los Angeles. And what's interesting about this film is that because Don Amos was a member of the community, dressed like them, spoke like them, it gave him access to the children's world without the kind of self-consciousness that would have met an outsider. And it really shows in the film.
A lot of things in the public school system are not taught in relation to black people. They're getting more into it in relation to history and so forth. But even in the sense of the application of these things, how should they be applied? The relationship. In the public school, they talk about George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and cats like that. Then what relationship, you know, do these people play in black people's lives? You know, it's definitely a relationship, but is the relationship taught? Or are they just teaching it to say that we are over you and you are down here? What relationship are they trying to make? Why is this being taught?
Clip from the 1971 film Ujamaa Uhuru Shule, Community Freedom School. It's a student film that talks in is talked about in the new book, Screening Race in American Non-Theatrical Film. I'm here with editors Allie Field and Marcia Gordon. So, I mean, this is fascinating, too, to think about it. And I wonder what you as scholars, and I'll ask you first, Marcia, what do you hope to gain from all of this?
Well, first off, one of the initiatives that was very important to Allie and I when we were putting this collection together was that people could actually see these films, because unlike theatrical films, which most people have ready access to, I mean, these are often buried in archives. They're not even cataloged sometimes. And so one of the things that we did was we worked with archivists and scholars all over the country to digitize this material and get it put online when it was not. And so at the Duke University Press website, there's a link to the streaming content of the film, which anyone can go and access. There's no paywall or anything. And the whole point is that people can see these images now and can think about them, and then the essays provide some historical context. So that was a major point for us.
Elliot, it's going to be great for all of us to see it and put it in perspective, but I guess we're going to need somebody else, like a scholar and somebody who's studied this also, to put it in context for us, particularly when we think about what came before all of this. So give me a sense of what this might lead to in your work.
Yeah, I think it's really important to have access to this material, as Marcia said, and also it fills in gaps in representation that we see. So when we look to the past for how did film represent Asian Americans, Mexican Americans, Native Americans, we don't see it in the, you know, the big screen as we talked about, but it's completely there in the history of these films. And so to make sure that people have access to that for their own communities, I think is really powerful. And then for our research, you know, this just is a treasure trove of material when you're interested, historians are interested in understanding these communities, how they self-represented, how they were represented by others, but also just to fill in the gaps in you know, understanding film history. This is a way to kind of correct the balance of, you know, the emphasis on Hollywood, white-authored and white-focused films, and to think about really just the way in which the lens had always been on non-white people. It's just we didn't have access to it.
And so what, Marcia, is the state of non-theatrical film today?
Well, that's an interesting question. So you may have heard of a little thing called YouTube. And so that's
I have one on my computer.
Yeah, that's just one of the places now where, you know, now we're talking about video and not film. You know, people whip out their iPhones for all manner of reasons, to document families. Maybe it's to document somebody getting beaten by a police officer. You know, there's a lot of different contexts where people are using their phones for frivolous and for unfrivolous reasons, and then they upload that content. Well, that's not getting played in a movie theater. That's being generated by whoever has access to the means of recording it. And so in some ways, this is about history written from the bottom up, right? I mean, certainly when you're talking about home movies, which anyone with, you know, a 16 or 8-millimeter camera was able to create representing their own family, as opposed to thinking about studios, which were white-owned, operated, and focused on profitability above all other things. There's a huge divide there, and I think we can still find that today. We just find it on the internet.
Allie, I wonder if in previously, before we had the internet and YouTube and all of that kind of self-made video, if these non-theatrical films that you include in your book had any influence. Was Hollywood paying any attention to what was going on there in terms of, you know, the kinds of things that might even be commercially successful?
The short answer is no, but there's some notable exceptions. And a lot of these filmmakers went on to work in Hollywood. And, you know, they made these films as side projects or as they were getting their foothold in the industry. And then they went on to, so there certainly was a sensibility that informed their later work. But some of these films had really quite broad distribution. I'm thinking of Black on Black, for example, which was a film made in 1968 by Joe Saltzman, and aired on televisions across the country through CBS affiliates. And it was advertised as sort of the Black community in South Central Los Angeles tells it like it is. No reporter, no interviews, and that kind of thing. And so it was seen by, you know, hundreds of thousands of people across the country. So some of these films had quite a wide reach.
The collection Screening Race in American Non-Theatrical Film is out now. Editor Allison Nadia Field is an associate professor and director of graduate studies at the University of Chicago. Allie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marsha Gordon's an editor as well, a professor at North Carolina State University, and a fellow at the National Humanities Center. Thanks, Marsha.
Thank you for having me.
You can find links to their work and see some of the films at our website, stateofthings.org. And also, they're going to talk about the book at screenings around the Triangle next year. That'll be there as well, to the extent that we know about them now. Just ahead, we're going to talk about an exhibit at the Nasher that features diverse work of Native American artists. Stay tuned.